Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, we got quite a crowd here today.
Good morning, sir. We most certainly do. This is going to be a lot of fun. We do have one newbie, but we also, no, two newbies, but we've got some veterans here in the studio. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Jackie Chu, because not too far around the corner, we got 10X Peachtree coming up.
That's right. That's always a lot of fun.
So that's going to be a fun. She's going to introduce us to Neil Martin, author of a book that we're going to learn more about. And Peter Bowerman is back in the studio.
Another author.
Yes. One who actually makes money at his craft.
Yes. Take a picture of him.
That's right. In fact, he's referred to as the well-fed writer.
And well-fed self-publisher.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that part.
He's evolving.
Got it. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce from Daybook Network, Atlanta Daybook. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Ms. Malinka Warner. How you doing?
Good morning, guys. I'm doing great. Thank you.
So you know all about this Daybook thing, don't you?
Yeah, you guys have been around forever, huh?
We just about. In Atlanta, over 15 years now.
Yeah. So how did the whole idea get started?
Well, actually, it got started because my husband was a business reporter. And
he's a recovering business reporter?
Yes, a recovering business reporter. And so many nonprofits in Atlanta, so many businesses were trying to get their stories in front of media people.
Right.
That what we did was we developed fax service. Yes, it was that long ago. Yes, a fax service before online.
The telegraph service was too slow.
Exactly, you know. So we developed as a fax service, and it was primarily for media. So at that point, it went to about 600 media people only every morning at 5 a.m.
So you guys, the Daybook, cobbled together a list of all the media people in town. It's very hyper-local, right? It's
absolutely.
And so you found all their fax numbers.
Exactly.
And then whose job was it to put all that stuff in the fax machine at 5 in the morning?
Actually, the day we came up with this story, it was an amazing kind of kismet. The technology for storing fax numbers and faxing it automatically from your computer was introduced that same week.
So that saved you some time.
So, yes, it saved us a tremendous amount of time. So now it's an online product. It's actually open to anyone who wants to subscribe. Yes, the media are still one of our core areas of readership, but we now have 7,000 subscribers in Atlanta and over 6,000 Twitter followers.
Now, how many of those are media?
About 30%.
Oh, so the rest of the people are just people interested in what's happening.
It's about 50% C-level and director level at companies in Atlanta, and then another 25% are nonprofits.
So how do you get your information? People, I don't guess, fax it in anymore, but they email it or call it in or submit it over the web?
Actually, Daybook at atlantadaybook.com is an online service, so folks sign up to become a contributor. They actually place their stories based on their different needs. Some events that are just coming into Atlanta might buy a 5-pack of stories, and other big agencies in Atlanta actually have annual plans with us.
So what's your take on this whole press release strategy? Is it still a viable strategy to send press releases out? And if so, surely there's some different ways to do it than back in the fax days, huh?
Well, I think that one of the biggest opportunities for companies now is certainly you can put your press release, and I think the best format for that or best venue for that is on your own website. But if you're trying to get a digital ripple going, which we say Daybook is the catalyst for your digital ripple.
I like that, digital ripple.
If you're trying to ride that ripple, what you really need to focus on is telling the story, engaging people in what it is you are talking about. So we see that press releases are changing their approach a little bit. A headline definitely that brings people in, but then actually just engages the person, helps them to see themselves in your story.
So there used to be a time when press releases were like, this company hired Bill Smith to be VP of sales. Like, that's like, whoa, can't wait to, you know, learn about more about that, you know, right? There was a time. So now you're saying that those are becoming less, and now there's more, you know, kind of thought starters or just kind of stories that are a catalyst for a reporter maybe to follow back up to learn more.
Absolutely. I think that there are still those companies that like to put that information out, but it's really more about telling the story of their growth.
Right.
They've added three new people, but that's because they just got an international appointment.
Right.
So I still see those, but not as often.
So as far as telling the story, is there some wisdom then in layering it with more than just one hit, like feeding them a little bit this week, a little bit next week? And like, we have an author that we're going to interview in some depth a little bit later in the program. His name is Neil Martin. So it strikes me that's a perfect application of telling the backstory and then just sort of unfolding it as it is. That
well, and you'll find out from speaking with Neil, the subject matter that he covers is very interesting. And
right.
So as a company or an organization that's trying to communicate that, at first you feel overwhelmed and want to talk about it all, right?
Right.
But people can't absorb that. So what you do is you usually take 3 to 5 stories, if you will, and serve that up with a headline and focus on a couple of main points and then change that up each time.
Now, do you have any tips for the nonprofits out there? There are so many of them that are trying to get the word out. What's an intriguing headline and what maybe a do and a don't for a nonprofit?
Well, a do is to talk about your mission within the body copy, which kind of leads to a do, which is talk about the good you're doing in your headline or something that will compel someone to have more information. And there's no textbook for it, or everyone would be doing it, but every nonprofit organization has a different mission and engages different audiences to help them accomplish those. So,
and your take on Twitter, is this just a fad for the kids,
no.
or is there some
oh,
viable
my goodness.
Application
yeah.
for this?
In fact, interestingly enough, I told you that about 30% of our subscribers are media
right.
on our email. We have many more media folks who are our Twitter followers because all of our stories are released on Twitter. And from what I've understood in talking with those media folks, it's all about engaging, right? And if
right.
I can engage them in 140 characters into clicking further to get more information, then I'm more likely to set up that path of engagement all the way through to the story.
Now, the Daybook is a it's evolved over time from fax machine to email to Twitter.
Yeah.
I hear also that you're expanding outside of Atlanta. Is that true?
Yep, we are. We are now in Nashville, just gearing up there, and we have probably 28 other U.S. cities, and as well we're looking at some international cities.
So now when you move into another market, do you have to put like boots on the ground there? You have somebody that's an affiliate for you, or you do that all remotely out of Atlanta?
No, we actually, I would say, manage out of Atlanta currently.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that we have reps in other cities. We begin to tap the folks who already live there. It's important that those people that are actually representing Daybook understand the PR market there. They understand the media folks there, because after all, Daybook is about engaging the local community.
Right, you're building community, right?
Absolutely. So it is vitally important that the person who is charged with that is a part of that community.
Now, how did you find this person?
Oh, well, in each city, we're actually just going and we're meeting with people. I go to PRSA meetings in other cities. I go to a lot of different nonprofit events and just kind of get to know folks that are there.
And then they bubble up, like they have an existing PR practice typically?
Well, right now, it's interesting. In the two cities that we're looking at starting, not necessarily. Some of the folks that are looking like front runners were once heads of communications at universities.
Oh, so they...
And one other one used to be, was a journalist for 20 years on the local NBC affiliate. So it just depends.
And then, so they got to really, though, buy in the mission, though, of building community around these...
Absolutely.
...these groups, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It is about community and just lifting the entire community up by sharing information that sometimes you don't read in other places.
Right.
Yeah.
Now,
you have to be relentless and vigilant. You can't take Thursday off in this business.
No.
I mean, there's no off days.
That's right. Like you guys. You can't just call and say, oh, no, I'm gonna wing it.
So now, when you go into a new market like that, Daybook's been around for a long time, so the people here are already comfortable with this as a safe place to share their news and their information.
Yeah.
when you're starting from scratch, do you have to kind of point back to Atlanta and show them, like, this is what it's going to look like in a 6 months or a year from now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, L.A. is a very good example. I have friends in L.A. who I'm just kind of, not that we're going to start in L.A., but we may, and it's definitely a possibility. Mm-hmm. But right now, in this initial stage, it's just about kind of sharing the right. information, having them look at Atlanta and begin to kind of visualize,
like,
what it
imagine,
is for their city.
Right. Oh, it looks like that there, but we're L.A., so we'll do it way better than
Southern. Oh, I'm so sure.
What do they know, right?
I'm so sure. So, yeah, it will be different in every community because every community is different.
Right.
Now, your husband was a business reporter.
He was.
What's your backstory? How did you get conned into this?
Well, actually, I was a former news director at a radio station. I worked my way through college. So back in the day, WAGQ in Athens, Q105. Mm-hmm. So I was the news director there. And then from there came to WGST. And I was not in front of the mic at WGST. I was worked with their state radio network, and I produced the Atlanta Falcons broadcast. So I had more of the backside of
right.
things there. But yeah, that was kind of my background.
And now you know, if you didn't already, how much harder it is to be in front of the mic. There's not much to it, is it?
No, it's all hard, actually.
So now, what is the biggest challenge here in Atlanta, now that it's kind of a mature market for you guys? How do you keep it fresh, and how do you keep serving your clients?
I think the same challenge that you have as a new business. You mm-hmm. just have to continually make your checklist every morning about, who do I want to reach this morning? What fun do I want to have? Who do I want to talk to?
So now, how do you, but like, a client comes to you and says, okay, I want to buy a, what do you call it, a 5-pack
right.
or a 10-pack
yep.
of releases?
Yeah.
How do you, do they know what they want already and you're just executing it? Or do they just say, hey, I heard about you guys, it sounds good, how would it benefit me?
Well, sometimes it can be an event, definitely. But I do have occasionally agencies or new companies who'll come to me and they'll say, I want to advertise my agency. Or I want to advertise this story, and I want to tell people all about us. And what I have to tell them is, okay, Daybook is not ad space. It's about serving up information that folks can get behind, or that uplifts them or tells them something new that they didn't know before. So you need to think about your story a little differently. What distinguishes your agency, or what makes you different as a nonprofit organization in the city? So I do work with the folks who are putting stories on Daybook, because it really isn't, it's not a platform to say we're the best, we're the, you know, it's about sharing something with all of us.
Right. You're trying to get a conversation started.
Exactly.
Like.
Exactly.
Not one finished by them cutting and pasting a document into whatever they have, right?
That's exactly right. And those are the ones that do actually, you know, we talk about that digital ripple. Those are the ones that ripple far further.
Right.
But is it appropriate at any time to provide some sort of call to action in a
oh,
press release?
Oh, every story, absolutely.
So you still do want a call to action. It's just not necessarily send me a check and I'll ship you. But wait, too.
Yes.
But that's not all.
For $9.99. No, it is definitely your call to – you have to know what you want, right? It's like boiling down to that 140
right.
characters. But in Daybook, it's about the main space in Atlanta Daybook. For each story is about the story itself. And then on the right-hand side is contact information if you want to give someone, you know, in the media especially, information about where to contact you. But also, okay, now go a little further. Now look at this stat sheet on our nonprofit. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, by the way, look at this company's actual website.
Now, do your clients ask you, like, well, how am I going to track the ROI of this?
Absolutely. And we are able to track the ROI of every single story. For our annual plan holders, what we do is we go even further, though. We are able to tell them how many people opened a story, but then we go further and look at how many visits through search. Because, again, we have this huge story archive on Atlanta Daybook
right,
or Daybook Network.
Because the number only gets bigger over time. It doesn't
only
get smaller.
That's like exactly right.
Some media is perishable. Like, it's there and then it's gone.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, it's like your show. You put your show, archive
right.
shows online. And that's
right.
what's awesome, because then folks can search
right.
on it. And
Google is forever.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, that's really what we kind of go that extra step on reporting, is we show you that. But then also we mix in that social media, and mm-hmm. now we can look at how far the ripple went, who were the main influencers of that message as it went out.
All right, so here's a 90-degree turn. And it's part of what I love about having conversations like this. We'll get a senior-level executive in here, and we'll talk all about their business. And all of a sudden, you learn that she collects stamps and, you know, trains well-bred dogs or something. But you really know a lot about this cybersecurity stuff. You're out, you're ordained, or you got the lapel pin or whatever, to teach people about cybersecurity, right?
Well, I am so glad you mentioned that, because that is something that I'm very passionate about. I am a trained presenter for the GBI's Cyber Safety Initiative, GBI CSI. And it was just a natural.
It was natural.
It did. My dad was very involved in law enforcement. He was also served on a couple of juvenile justice committees under a couple of governors. And so that was always a part of my upbringing. So when I became more in tune with this online world and began to kind of see some of the dangers with it, obviously I've been in it since it started, I just wanted to see if there was more I could do with that. The GBI had a program that I actually met through some FBI contacts. And so with that, they asked if I would like to become a trained presenter. So schools, it's all about telling this message of cybersecurity. And also, right now, one of our initiatives is cyberbullying and kind of helping parents to see it's the same thing you do with your kids right now. You're involved. You have to know the rules of this online playground. And it's not to scare them, but it's also just to inform them about the opportunities that they have to keep their kids and their own families safe.
Now, is there anything that a parent can do? Is there websites that are out there that can help the parent, you know, educate them?
Well, absolutely. NetSmarts out of New Zealand is an awesome you should know that NetSmarts, of course, has a zero tolerance for child pornography. They are leading the world in...
So some places have some tolerance?
I would say the U.S. is cracking down on it, but we certainly have some holes there where that is running rampant. So that's why it's even more important that families and their children understand that. So,
right.
I can definitely leave you guys with a link, and you can put it online for community groups to request presenters. It goes directly to the GBI, and then they coordinate it with a list of trained presenters.
Maybe you can come back with somebody from that group, and we can do a whole segment.
I'd love to bring the GBI in. Yeah, you guys.
Well, whoa.
Okay.
No, I think that'd be fantastic.
That's awesome.
Kevin, you may need to call in sick that day.
He's not allowed to be within 50 yards of a GBI.
Okay, all right. We'll check that, Kevin.
But you're a walking, talking reality show. You have so many facets to your life and your career. You recently spoke in front of the music folks.
Oh, yeah? The Americana Music Association. Yeah. If you don't know that genre, you will. But the Americana Music Association is based in Nashville. And I was asked to speak there about this concept of online promotion. And I learned an awful lot about the challenges of the music industry. And I actually gained a lot of respect for what you guys do with this radio show, because it's clear that we're all struggling with how do we connect with all of these people who have never been more connected.
Right. It's so fragmented, but it's so it's everywhere. So
exactly.
It's kind of
so
opposites.
This concept that you have in terms of the show and bringing business people together, I know that you have the concept for the trade show, radio in your booth. Those are the ways that you engage with people, and you just have to be aware of them. But yes, the music industry has their own challenges with iHeartRadio and Pandora, and
But you're everybody's friend. You're what you guys play with all companies that want to get the word out, right?
Yep, organizations, large and small, nonprofits.
What's
PR
your sweet
agencies.
Spot on who uses your service the most? Is it business people? Is it nonprofits?
Well, I would say that it's about half and half.
Mm-hmm.
Businesses, and that could be corporations, communications departments within corporations, PR agencies, and nonprofits, definitely. Atlanta has more nonprofits than a lot of major cities.
Do you know how many they have about?
Jackie, do you know?
I have no idea.
Figures?
We have a lot.
Yes, it's huge.
Hundreds?
Oh, well, no.
We have, Atlanta has the headquarters of CARE, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
American Cancer Society, the Boys and Girls Club.
Right, Arthritis Foundation.
Arthritis Foundation, just to name a few.
It's thousands.
Yeah. Oh, it's thousands?
Yes.
Wow.
So what's next and how can we help? Aside from the reality show, I'm quite serious about that.
I think, well, with only so with you too.
Right? Right, well, that'll be part of the segment is like your weekly radio show come in and they tape some of that. But
Well, you guys just did it. Thanks for the opportunity to come and talk about Daybook. We're growing and we're happy about that. But Atlanta Daybook, it's been here for a long time. If folks don't know about it, certainly go over to atlantadaybook.com.
And also, since this is an internet-based show where people listen everywhere, are you looking for affiliates in different markets as well? You mentioned Nashville.
I would say that you can go to daybooknetwork.com, www.daybooknetwork.com, and you can take a look at the cities that we're looking at.
And then, so if you have the background that's appropriate, then maybe they can reach out to you through that.
Absolutely.
Well, what a delight to have you in the studio.
Well, thank you, guys.
And this idea is quite sincere. I think it'd be fantastic to have those folks come back with you, and we'll do another segment.
I would love that, and I know they would as well.
Right, that's important.
Yeah. You going to hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Yes, please. I'd love to. You've got some interesting folks you're talking to.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us back in the studio, Miss Jackie Chu. How you doing, sunshine?
Doing just fine. Good morning.
Good morning. What'd you learn in that last segment?
Well, I learned a lot. Didn't know about the GBI connection with Malenka.
That was new.
And but I do want to start by thanking Malenka and Daybook for being such a wonderful supporter of TEDx Peachtree for the last 3 years now. Actually, no, since inception, since 2009 when we had our first event. They have been tremendously – TEDx Peachtree is a nonprofit, and we are one of their nonprofits, and we've really appreciated all the guidance and the support that they've given us these last 5 years. So thank you.
Thank you.
So Jackie, before we get too far into it, why don't you share for the people who aren't familiar TEDx versus TED and TEDx Peachtree versus the other things that are going around town?
Absolutely. I think I have this one down at this point. So TED is an annual conference that happens, that was founded in the mid-1980s, and TED stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. Not Ted Turner, not the airline, not the movie. Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And it happens once a year in California. And in 2000, and they're known for their TED Talks. So most people know them through TED Talks, which are available on TED.com. They're available for free through the iPhone as well as the Android app. TED has their own app and essentially serves up these talks at no cost. Talks are between 6 and 18 minutes. They're famous because they're known for they're not commercial talks. They can't be about products. They have to be about ideas worth spreading, and those are generally defined as ideas that could change humanity and change the way we live and make us a better world. It's they're lofty ambitions, and we strive every day at TEDx Peachtree to meet the ideals. So they essentially started granting licenses to the alumni, folks who had attended TED conference back in 2009. And the founder of TEDx Peachtree, Al Myers, was at Turner at the time, and he applied to be one of these licensees. These licenses are granted at no cost. But as part of the deal, there is a very large, very thick manual that comes with it. And those are guidelines and rules that TED, they don't suggest, that they mandate, essentially, that we uphold the TED brand. The X in TEDx stands for independently organized, meaning that TED does not tell the organizers what content, what speakers to pick. They do not provide us with any financial support. Every single TEDx in the world, and there are over 2,000 groups now in the world, and there have been more than 4,000, I could be wrong on this, but the numbers might even be bigger, but they're over 4,000 events, TEDx events, since 2009. And the staggering stat is on any given day of the week, there are 7 TEDx events going on somewhere in the world.
Wow.
So that is the TEDx Peachtree is part of that global community, and we're very fortunate. Now, in Metro Atlanta itself, there are 6 TEDx groups. And TEDx Atlanta and TEDx Peachtree are the two oldest, so we're the granddaddies, if you would. And there are other groups that have emerged in town, and we are extremely collaborative. In fact, some of them are actually coming to the conference, to our conference, November 8th.
And each year you have a theme, right?
Absolutely. We
we have a theme, and we've been asked, you know, well, how do you decide on the theme? And quite honestly, it's a group of us getting together and brainstorming. And
is alcohol involved?
Well,
there's a rumor. There was a rumor that
adult libations are sometimes served along with other crunchies to go with that. So this year our theme is catalyze, which I found. So the word catalyst was used quite a bit in the last.
See that, Malika? That was good.
Wow.
I promise this was not planned. And so the theme was catalyze, and it's the whole idea of people and events that change the way we live, that change the way we think, that change the way we behave, which become the behave part is significant. I'll tell you why in a quick second. So we have this theme this year, and we curate our speakers, the content, the heart of the show, according to this theme. And so all our speakers, there are 17 this year, 15 of which are published now on TEDxPeachtree.com. We've held back a couple because we always like to have a couple of surprises
little
every
mystery.
Year. Little, yes, like, you know, like an Easter egg hunt. I mean, how fun is that, right? So we have that. And so we have speakers ranging from folks. There's going to be an amazing pediatrician who's going to be talking about pain management, needle phobia, and the impact that it could have on public health. It's a really serious topic, one that I had no clue about until we met Amy. Amy Baxter is her name. And then we also have the executive director of Wellspring, and they're a nonprofit that essentially has a program to help survivors of human sex trafficking. This is a very, very serious issue in Atlanta, and she will be also taking the stage, and there'll be a surprise on that one too. So really powerful talks, and so now I'm going to get into the kind of never thought about it before, but gosh, it's so relevant kind of a person. We actually have a speaker here in the studio with us, Neil Martin. He's a Renaissance man. So I'm going to go ahead and kind of throw it to him.
Welcome to the show, Neil. Yeah.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
We are delighted to have you. You brought a copy of your book with you for me, I think. Probably not Lee. We'll let Lee touch it, though, right?
It has pictures.
So,
it's for me.
So tell us about this book and what compelled you to write it, man.
All right. So the book is called Habit, the 95% of Behavior Marketers Ignore. And it was kind of a bizarre process that I had been – I have a doctorate in marketing from Georgia Tech, so just weird from the beginning.
But you're successful anyway, I understand.
Exactly. I've overcome that. And it's my undergraduate journalism degree from the University of Georgia, I'm sure, that shored me up. But as we were as I was spending a tremendous amount of time working in high technology during the 90s, which was – fantastic fortune that I was in the middle of kind of the internet rollout. I was hired to explain the internet to companies.
Oh, my.
So, I mean, it was where you'd walk in and say, no, this is going to be big. I promise. This is going to matter. You know, banks, retail organizations.
We're
gonna
going to just like, stay in the newspapers. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. I presented to a group of bankers, and I had two or three senior banker guys come up to me and go, you know, this is really looking like I should be retiring before all of this happens. So we just do not want to deal with this transition. But through all of this, you know, there was this tremendous focus on the technology and you know, what technology to put in place. And my background is heavily in psychology. I'd been an alcohol and drug counselor for several years, and I ended up not paying attention and found myself as a hospital administrator in San Antonio, Texas. And that was what led me to go back to school. But in this time frame, of really kind of combining psychology and marketing, I really understood that people were just not paying attention to the customer. They weren't really thinking through what the customer wanted. It's like, oh, here's this new technology, and they just kind of hand it to you. Oh, like 100 gigabits. You know, this is going to mean something to somebody. And what I kind of as I was looking at these phone companies who wanted to compete against the cable guys and some of the technology they were picking, it was like you're going to have to reteach me how to watch television. It's like, this doesn't make any sense. And so I did this presentation for a group of these telephone companies and, you know, kind of looking to make it interesting. And I just came up with this thing, become your customer's habit, not their choice. I've done hundreds of these things before, but I've never had anything resonate like that. So I thought, oh, well, this is clever. You know, become your customer's happy. You know, I was used to be a journalist. 90 days, I'll crank out a book. This will be clever.
And I guess your drug counseling background helped in that, right?
Exactly. That was huge, huge for that whole process. But when I started doing the research, and then all of a sudden everything changed because I began to realize these fundamental problems we've seen in marketing for 30 years, but we just kind of kept bypassing, which is the idea that, you know, if I convince you that I have a better product, you'll buy it. And yet we still have 85% of new products failing every year. Right, you know, companies are spending billions of dollars bringing out new products, new services, and they go nowhere. And we have my dissertation was in customer satisfaction, and you know, you spend 3 years in customer satisfaction to discover that customer satisfaction doesn't matter. You know, I can know how satisfied you are; it doesn't tell me what you're going to do next. What? Why am I spending all this money? This doesn't make a lot of sense. But when I started doing the research, and I had a pretty good background in psychology, so I was able to get my brain around a lot of it, all of a sudden everything flipped for me because I realized that, you know, the neuroscience kind of psychology people over the last 15 years had really discovered counterintuitively that most of what we do comes out of the unconscious mind, not the conscious mind. And so when you start talking about what somebody intends to do, well, they usually do less than half of what they intend to do. You know, I can know your attitude, doesn't tell me what you're going to do. I can know your satisfaction, doesn't tell me what you're going to do. So when you really start thinking about, you know, the only thing that's going to tell me what you do is what you do, you know, is what you've done in the past. And in the research, it became fascinating. It makes sense when you think about it that we evolved, you know, over millions of years and our brains evolved over millions of years. But consciousness is very new. This idea of self-awareness may be only 50 or 60,000 years old, and Homo sapiens are only 100,000 years old. So we had this tremendously complex ecosystems, tremendously complex behavior long before we had consciousness. But because we're consciousness, and we're conscious now, we just assume everything we do is coming out of our conscious decision-making. And when you realize it's not, there's this huge revelation that, oh, most of my advertising is wasted. Because, you know, when you're shopping, you're not thinking about what you saw in the ad. And even if I convinced you that, you know, my widget was better, you don't care because you don't think you have a problem anyway. You know, so there's this huge disconnect in terms of thinking about, oh, I want you to love me. I want you to love my brand. As opposed to understanding, what do I have to do to get you to use me every day without thinking about it? I'd much prefer you to use me without thinking about me than to love me. Because if you love me, you're thinking about me, and the moment I disappoint you, you will hate me, and then you'll go to somebody else.
So, but how does that happen in real life? I mean, that sounds good theoretically, but how do companies actually tactically execute that?
Right. So you have to think a lot about this idea of the process. So you do need to make a conscious appeal. I mean, so Malinka's story is perfect. I mean, you know, everything she's trying to do is to cut through the clutter. You know, we are so crowded in our lives. There's so much information. So how do I write a headline that somebody's going to, you know, be attracted to, that's going to cut through the clutter, and they're going to say, I want to learn more about that. So that's working with how the brain works. Our brains are designed to filter out things that are irrelevant. So it's not like you're not having to make a great product. You're not having to appeal to the conscious mind. But you have to think through, what's the behavior that I'm looking to get? What does the customer need to do? What are the steps for them to use my service? I mean, to look at, you know, the breakdown in the healthcare website. You know, you start thinking about this idea of, I go to a website, how many steps are you willing to take before you go, no, this is too much?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the number of steps is how bad do you want it?
Exactly. I mean,
like the people that are 20 years old and that the government wants to use it, they're going to try it once, and if it doesn't work, they're going to say, well, that didn't work. But the person who needs the insurance, like they need air, they're going to sit there for 3 days and press the button until it works.
Right, and that's, you know, unfortunately, the Achilles heel of the system, because the whole thing has to be, I've got to get those 20-year-olds to sign up to fund the that's the principal funding mechanism, is to get enough people to pay into the system who probably won't use it for a long time, to make it work. And so you're creating a mechanism by which the customers who are going to be the most expensive to carry are going to be the ones who you let in the door. And this is kind of similar to lots of different kinds of companies. You look at the customers that they're constantly going after are the ones who are often the ones who are going to churn the fastest, And the ones that they ignore are the ones who have been there the longest and the ones that are generating the most revenue for them.
Right. So they're taking them for granted.
Absolutely. And then so for the first time that they – and they think that they that these customers can be ignored because they're habitual. But the first time that that habit gets broken and you find – you know, another store, another phone, another – I mean, then you can lose them as completely as you once used to have them.
So are you finding execs are resonating with this message and in this conversation, or does some really push back, or are you finding your sweet spot?
That's a great question.
That was a fantastic question.
It was. I think of all of the questions I've been asked and doing like, this for
– He's trying to get you in the habit of telling him that he's doing a great job.
But so when the book came out, it was interesting because you know I thought, oh well, okay, I've done this thing and it's gotten out and it's done well, and it went through, I don't know, a couple of printings, went through hardback, paperback, translated into 10 languages. The things you kind of look at as kind of okay, that's good. But the people who really embraced it first were the folks who were in market research and consumer insights. And they embraced it because it explained why everything they were doing wasn't working. So you have a company, a huge Fortune 100 company, number one in their space, who bring you in and they talk about it. It's hysterical because they're pretty honest at this point, but they're like, you know, they were this one company that makes a food product, and they'd done all of their rigorous testing on this new idea. And they had like this bar. You have to like get 80% of the people who test it have said they'll probably or definitely buy this product before we take it to market. And they got fantastic results. Like 93% of the people said that they would probably or definitely buy it. So they were like very, very confident, very, very excited about bringing this thing out, which died, just absolutely died. But they'd done something clever, which is to actually follow the people who had been in the survey to find out how many of them had actually, bought.
So they asked them?
Yeah.
So they asked him point blank. You said you're going to buy this, and you didn't buy it. What happened?
Right. 3%. 3% of the people, 3% of those 93% of the people said they probably or definitely buy, actually bought it.
Wow.
So when you start looking at that, well, what's the breakdown? Well, when I go to the store, I'm in complete autopilot mode. I am, there might as well be a little wire underneath the
floor. I can tell you
floor.
Right now, I'm going to pick up some lima beans and some cheese grits because I'm in the habit of it.
Exactly.
And I know I'm going to do that.
Right. So you look at, a store has 45,000 products in it, but, mom can go through that on her weekly trip. She can get her 30 items in 25 minutes. I mean, you think about the cognitive efficiency of that. There are 45,000 products in there. She comes out with 30 in 25 minutes. And it's, but if you go backwards through the store, it'll take you an hour and a half. And the issue here is how much of that stuff just becomes so routinized, and that's what makes us efficient. And that's the problem with habits, is we think of them only their negative side. But in reality, there's a part of your brain that's designated for recording these things so that your conscious brain can be thinking about something else while your unconscious brain is executing this behavior.
So you're saying like grocery stores should just periodically block out aisles to force them through new ways in
There's
order to
idea.
Change well, you their know, habit?
It's hysterical because that's – I mean when we don't understand how the brain works, I mean this is what we do. So countries like the U.S. and Europe, when people in these countries, when they go into a store, they automatically turn right. England, Japan, where they drive on the wrong side of the road, they go in, they automatically turn left.
Wow.
If you design a store opposite of what people want to do, you put up a barricade, they will break the barricade down to go the way they want to go. Because, it's something that just it feels natural. And this is the part where I think for all companies, instead of having this goal of I want my customers to love me, it should really be that if they're not using my product, it just doesn't feel right. There's a wrongness to it, and to get to that point, it's about being part of a routine. Part of that's the way I get that thing done. I don't think about it; it's automatic. And as a goal, I mean, to your question before about are people getting it? Some companies are, and some companies, I mean, have been there long before my book came out. I mean, you look at Procter & Gamble; I think they're probably the best at really understanding that if they're going to get a big success like they need. Then they really need to have to become part of that habitual process. But
so they got to use the habit for their benefit instead of against them.
Well, to me, what I try to get companies to understand is you want to work the way the customer's brain works.
Right.
So what Apple has taught all everyone should understand that a large part of Apple's success is their genius at designing for both the conscious and the unconscious brain. But the reality is nobody wants to have to read a manual. Right? I mean, could you – and you think about the complexity of the iPhone when it came out and even the iPod and all of the different things it could do, and yet we never had to read a manual. And before, you know, it was anything that you got was this turgid, horribly written, incredibly complex thing. And so it's like something as trivial as like VCRs, the old technology, I know, but we'll go back. But, you know, they had this ability to record programs. And
which was like an amazing thing.
Right, which was an amazing thing. But 90% of people never recorded a program. They just watched pre-recorded tapes on them.
Right.
And so what was fascinating was, you know, that this whole notion about, you know, about TiVo and how it took off. I mean, you know, it's the one piece of technology that if it broke today, my wife would say, go replace that. And this is, but these things that are designed with the way the brain works, then they have a much better chance of being successful. And so, I mean, you know, I kind of get a pushback periodically about, you know, the manipulation potential here about, you know, you're working with the unconscious brain. And to me, it's all about, you know, if you're a good company and you're really trying to be successful, then, you know, you have to be trusted by your customer. I have to trust that your product, your service, whatever deal we've got is working. And the moment that you betray that trust, I can't use you habitually. I can't use you unconsciously because now you're always going to be the person I have to keep an eye out on. And I'm just looking to find somebody I can trust. And that's the, I think, the biggest takeaway in terms of, you know, this isn't some formula to how do I manipulate customers, because that's the surest way to kill your brand.
To fail fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also you have to be disruptive enough so they give you a chance. Like on the iPod, they resonated with the customer because they weren't talking in terms of, like you said earlier, gigabytes. They were selling you 1,000 songs. They weren't selling you 3 gigabytes, which is meaningless. I don't even know how to convert gigabytes to songs. And the iPod was selling me 1,000 of my songs. I know how many songs I have, and I can just plop them in there in an elegant, easy-to-use manner.
Absolutely.
So I'll try it then.
Absolutely, and that was absolutely the key. I was heavily involved in the with telephone companies at that time, and Samsung actually came out with a really neat product called the Samsung Uproar, which was this cell phone that was also an MP3 player, you know, and that, you know, way ahead of everybody else. And it was really, I mean, it really worked well. And I'm apparently the only person who still remembers this.
Right.
Yeah, I still have one in my drawer at home. So, you know, it's much more than just the technology. It's about understanding that, you know, how do I make this thing used every day? Because you think about the complexity. I mean, if I was designing something that had 1,000 songs on it, I was like, well, how are they going to search? I might have to put a keyboard in there. I have to, you know, here are all these things I'm going to have to do. And yet they were able to, with this incredible elegance and simplicity, you know, create this thing that, you know, without a manual, you know, you could very quickly master.
You could figure it out enough to use it and be happy with it.
Absolutely. And that's that fast feedback mechanism, which is, again, communicating to the unconscious part of the brain. I'm not trying to consciously tell you how to do this. I'm trying to show you how to do it. And that's how your unconscious brain will rapidly master that, whatever the technology is, if it's presented that way.
So, Jackie, where'd you find this guy? What is your process? Let's back up a little bit, because I can see. I mean, what a delight this is going to be to have speakers of this caliber at TEDx Peachtree.
This is the tip of the iceberg.
This is the iceberg, Jackie.
he's the cover band. He's not even the headline.
Exactly.
No. We've been very, very fortunate. We have an open nomination process in that anyone can nominate anyone who has an idea worth sharing on our website. We currently have that turned off. Because
enough ideas already.
because our event is 16 days away.
Right.
But on event day, that online form will automatically turn back on.
Uh-huh.
And we also have, so there are two different ways. There's the inbound and the outbound. So we have folks who proactively nominate people, and they nominate themselves, which they can. And there are people that we reach out to because we know their work and there's an idea that we're sharing in there. And so we proactively reach out to them. There is a group of us, we have a board, because we are a Georgia nonprofit, and our board curates. So when a nomination comes in, so regardless of whether it's someone who nominated themselves online or someone that we reached out to, even if we've reached out to someone, we encourage them to fill out the nomination form. In fact, they have to. And that is how it floats to us, the board, and we meet once a month. And we essentially evaluate everything that comes in. Many times there would be very lively conversations among us about the merit of that particular nomination and how it fits into the flow of what we're curating for that year, the theme, and whether, so I'll give you an example. If we have three business, very marketing, consumer marketing type focused talks that were really equally great, we really have, you know, what we would have, and we can't have three of those at our conference. We curate for variety, essentially. We basically would then go out and proactively reach out to the three nominees and have conversations with them. And then we'll come back, report the findings to the group, and basically do another debate, have another debate, and then put it to a vote. So all speakers are selected based on a majority vote within that group.
Well, you're doing your job effectively because you certainly catalyzed me. I mean, what an exciting topic. Tell us just a little bit more about what we can expect at this event, and then let's make sure that we leave our listeners with connection points because are there still seats available?
So we have, as of this morning, we have 12 tickets left.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's okay. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, because we have 12 listeners. It works out perfect.
Call now. So we're actually, so with 16 days to go, we're actually talking to Bucket Theater, which is where it is this year again. Mm-hmm. We're talking to them to see if there's some way for us to expand.
So you need them to expand.
So that's sort of where we are today. So we're really excited. We feel incredibly fortunate that the community is behind this idea of having Peachtree, and they've enjoyed the programming enough to want to come back. We have a lot of people who are coming back from previous years and who've been supportive of the type of programming that we provide. In terms of, so TEDx Peachtree is where folks want to go if they are interested in looking at the full list of speakers. It is an immersive conference. It is not like other conferences. There are no how-tos. There are no 10 ways to be more productive. There are no, here's my product and here's how great my company is. There's none of that. Our goal is the goal for every single year. We curate speakers who are the heart of our conference on and our experience to inspire. So we've had attendees who've called our event a brain spa, akin to giving yourself, going just as we go to a spa, we have a spa day, it's akin to going to a day where we give our brain a workout that it needs and a reprieve from the day-to-day routines that we're used to just go for a day and experience 8 hours of difference, of different things. We are doing something a little different. Every year we add a couple of different new elements. We are providing our attendees, based on their feedback, with ways to act on what they hear at the conference. And so I'll just leave it at that as a teaser.
In the coffee situation? Well, the cheese grits are across the street. But we could get
last year. Yeah, it was crazy coffee.
Oh, man,
the
awesome.
Coffee nerd. Yeah, it was Nirvana.
So
there.
Right. So Jason. Yes. So we had Jason Domini, who is just fabulous. He basically got 10 of his barista friends from all over the country to fly in, drive in, road
wild.
Trip in on their own dime to essentially give coffee tastings all day long. It was off the chain. We were highly caffeinated. So there are a couple things on the coffee front this year. So we're doing a similar thing but different. Thrive Farmers are our sponsor of coffee this year. And what makes them really super cool is they have, it's kind of techie, but what it means to the rest of us is for the very first time, you guys can actually know who the farmer is of that cup of coffee that you will be drinking.
Wow.
So you will actually be able to know who that is because they essentially are they have a vertically integrated supply chain process where they have the roasting and the processing process, which is really expensive. The equipment's expensive. And they are actually allowing farmers to basically process through them. And their promise is they actually can give the farmers 10 times more than fair trade in terms of return of investment than fair trade coffee.
That's nice. And they're going to get them in the habit of using their roasters. Right, Neil?
They have every incentive. They have every incentive. The farmers have every incentive to do that from a financial point of view. Yeah. But also, more importantly, it's just taking the whole coffee idea to more of a wine idea where, you know, we all know right. This wine from this vineyard by this winemaker is awesome.
Right.
So now you're going to be able to say, well, I like this coffee from this farmer.
From Bill.
Right. In Costa Rica. In this region of Costa Rica. So you're now able to say that I like his beans right. versus, you know, Pedro's beans in I don't know, Argentina.
Right.
So it's a really fascinating concept. And they're right here. So Thrive Farmers is actually right here.
Really?
In Georgia. How
all right.
About
so
that?
We got to, because we're going to get a chance to cover this, right? We're going to be at this thing?
Yes. Yeah, so thank you again for Business Radio X for live podcasting at our event. We're really excited to have y'all. A couple of other immersive sort of engage the five senses experiences that attendees can expect is we are bringing back frozen pints.
Yes.
Yay! For those of you who don't know, it is the craft beer ice cream.
Of course.
Yes.
It's a mashup.
It is a mashup. And they will be featuring some of their seasonal, much like craft beer has seasonal beer, we will be featuring seasonal flavors. And Social Box will again be there.
Oh, great.
So
we love Social Box. In fact, not long after that, we interviewed him there on site, but we also brought him in the studio. That's right. a really cool concept. And we might even explore doing some stuff with him out on the road. They're doing some neat work.
And this is the sort of connections that TEDx Peachtree is all about. Right. We love that. We love hearing that.
Fantastic.
Now Neil, do you have a website for your business?
Yeah, it's called Sublime Behavior. Well, my company is Sublime Behavior Marketing, and the website's sublimebehavior.com.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we are really looking forward to that. We had so much fun last year. Do you remember? I mean, it almost looked like a meth lab there at one end of the coffee thing where the guy was boiling the thing.
All different techniques to make coffee.
Like five.
Do you like coffee, Malika?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Love
you
coffee.
So these were the nerdiest coffee people. They were weighing it to the gram of the coffee. They heated it up in a variety of different ways. It was all these different techniques of making coffee at a bar, in a bar setting. So one guy was making it one way, another guy was making it a different way, and they were great. They were chemists.
So did you come away with a new appreciation or a new habit?
I bought a new espresso machine.
Really?
Or actually, I conned my parents into buying it.
Oh, very nice.
it was really a cool thing to see. I mean, literally, they were chemists. The temperature had to be an exact temperature.
You know, I've heard that makes a difference.
The water was a special water. And the they were measuring the coffee ground a certain way at a certain type of grinding. It was crazy.
We drank a lot more coffee than we did interviews, I think.
I think so. It was that good.
We had other talent on board there, too. We had a writer from one of the papers that I think was...
All right.
Jackie knows everybody in town, so she hooked us up with that guy. All right. Well, we have another conversation coming up. Please join me in welcoming back to the studio the well-fed publisher, Mr. Peter Bowerman. How you doing, man?
Very good. Glad to be here.
Well, you were very polite, very well-behaved. You know, sometimes people sitting in the cheap seats before they get up to the, you know, the...
They heckle. They throw things.
Just tempted to
jump. Or you can
in
see
there.
Them jotting down notes, you know, right. Scores and evaluation and cheats and stuff like that. But this TEDx Peachtree thing's exciting, and Malinka's work, it's kind of cool, huh?
This is a tough crowd to follow.
I don't know. Well, you started out back in the day as the well-fed writer, right?
Yes.
So now you've evolved into the well-fed self-publisher. When did that transition occur?
Well, that's the problem. I have two platforms at once.
Oh.
So the well-fed writer is about commercial freelancing, and I wrote three books in that series, which I self-published pretty successfully. I've basically paid all my bills with my books since 2001, so I wrote how I did that. So and the new edition just came out. So
now self-publishing, at one point there was kind of a stigma like that's not real publishing.
Correct.
But now it seems like everybody's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, the stigma is off, but there's a new stigma now because so much of the stuff that's being self-published, because it's so easy to self-publish, right, is crap.
So now, but now there's a way to do it that is more professional than just somebody that
takes
a Word document and throws
it on there's
the
always
Kindle.
Been a way to do it that's more professional. It's just it was more expensive.
Right.
So, and now with CreateSpace and Lightning Source and all that, anybody can self-publish. So
what are the keys to your success then? Other than you must be a better writer than some, right? So that's got to be part of it. But what else?
Well, I think I had an epiphany a couple of years ago, and it kind of formed the basis of this new edition of the book. And that is, within the space of a week, I had three things happen. It's always three things that get
sure.
your mind running. And the first one was I saw a review on Amazon for the earlier copy of the book saying, you know, I do seminars on self-publishing, and his book has risen to the top of my recommended list. And then I got an email from somebody, and they said, I should be on your payroll because I'm out there, you know, promoting your book to everybody I talk to. And then I got a third email from a guy saying, I read your book. I read a bunch of books on self-publishing, and yours was by far the best, which is why I'm contacting you for some coaching. And he ended up doing his book title and his back cover copy, which that's also something I do. And so this little light bulb went on, and it was the most powerful, number one most powerful book marketing strategy of them all, which sounds very hyperbolic, but, you know, is, you ready for this? Write a really good book.
Wow. You get that down, sir?
Now we laugh. We're laughing, right? We're laughing here, but I'm very serious about this. I mean, you think about when you find a great restaurant, you know, or a great movie, or a great book. You know, what do? You know, you tell people about it,
right?
Okay, and I have seen in the 13, almost 14 years in the self-publishing world, how many people put out garbage or stuff that isn't ready for prime time, or they chintz on the cover design or the editing or whatever, and they have to struggle to keep the book, you know, pumping the book up. Whereas if you do, you know, the best you can possibly do and have a goal of making that book the best in its class, okay, then you will recruit an army of unofficial salespeople who will be out there promoting you, you know, left and right. And the key really to all this is that when I do workshops, I say, what's the difference between this part of the process and the marketing part of the process? And eventually somebody guesses it. You have complete, total, 100% control over the
content,
creation of
right.
the content and the packaging of your book. Once you get into the marketing realm, you're...
Not so much.
Not so much. I mean, you can take the actions, but the results of those actions are, you know, out of your hands largely.
Now, does this self-publishing work for fiction as well as nonfiction?
Yes.
And then in your case, are you talking more to the fiction or nonfiction?
I'm really talking more to the nonfiction crowd because that's what I know. And ideally, nonfiction how-to, you know. Books, you know, books like Neil's, for instance, you know, where it isn't necessarily a how-to, but it's more of a, you can find the audience that would be, you know, open to that kind of idea. Whereas a novel, unless it's a very specific genre, is much more broad-based in its appeal. So.
And so the strategies are different.
Well, they are, but it's funny. In the original edition of the book, I had a section where I was like, you know, fiction's a different animal, you know, and these things may not work as well just because it's so much harder to get traction as a fiction author. And then I had a whole bunch of people email me, say, you know, hey, that's what you said, but I'm a fiction writer and I used your, you know,
techniques and it worked.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, my, you know, the cover blurb is from a woman who won both the 2011 International Writers Digest International Self-Published Awards, and she was the Ben Franklin Award winner for Best First Book, which are like two very prestigious awards. And she was one of my clients, and she said, I follow this book, you know, to the letter, and I know this is why, so, hey, who am I to say?
And if I can chip in real quick here.
Jump right in, Neil.
Yeah,
please.
You know, speaking of somebody who's gone through this process, and I was incredibly fortunate to get published traditionally, but because of the consolidation in the publishing world, it's so hard to get published. And the research that they showed me was when they're selling a book into the big book markets, they have 8 seconds. They have 8 seconds to sell a book. That in the bookstore you have 3 seconds. So the whole idea of what gets published and what doesn't is often so much just about, do you have a pitch? And the idea of people who have the kind of experience and insights that can only really come out in a book, that the self-publishing is for, I think, the vast majority of people, the only option they're ever going to have to realistically control their fate.
Right. And not only the deal, and this is one reason why I self-publish, because the deal that, published authors get just isn't, in my mind, just wasn't that great. I mean, you give up the rights, you give up creative control of the process, you give up the timetable. I can self-publish a book once it's done in 5 or 6 months. It could be 18 to 24, through a publisher. You give up most of the money, and you still, even all after that, you still have to do most of the marketing yourself.
Right. I guess that's one of the myths, right? Like people think I'm going to go get traditionally published and then I just sit
off
back
to my neck, right?
Right.
My next
and then
book.
I'll go to Oprah. They'll schedule my Oprah appearance to my Today Show.
You know what they call the whole Oprah thing in the book world?
What is that?
The Phantom of the Oprah.
Is it more myth?
Well, it's just that's about how likely it is going to be for it to happen.
But short of a piece of software, I got to believe a well done book has got to be one of the most leverageable.
Well,
pieces, right?
Right, absolutely. And it comes down to, Neil was saying that, you have to have a pitch, but you self-publish and you can bypass the entire, industry. All you care about is who is your audience for that book and how can you reach them. And I've been very successful in reaching, the people who care about these subjects. And I don't care at all what the wider publishing world thinks of my book or whatever. I mean, I've won a number of awards, so in that realm, I guess they thought it was pretty good. But you have much more control over your fate.
But like Neil, he has a marketing agency. This book is a card, right?
Right.
This gets him an appointment with somebody because he has a book. I mean, it's a $25 business card in his case,
right? And so you're saying that's just
it's a market. It's part of a business's marketing plan. It could be writing a book, right?
Absolutely,
and they control the whole process if they self-publish.
That's right. And when was the last time you looked at no offense to any published authors, but when's the last time you as a book buyer said, "Oh, that was published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich"?
Right. I only read Knopf.
Exactly. He's a Knopf guy.
Right. That's it.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. Unless it says on the, unless it says on the cover, Peter Bowerman Publishing, which would just brand me
it's a vanity
amateur,
press, right.
So there's a tip, right?
Don't name it.
Don't
your name.
Don't name it your publishing. Yeah. Your publishing company.
It's kind of. I'd like to think that.
So
be obvious.
I got to know. What is your? You have these two successful books. You've had a career doing everything from writing copy for commercial applications. What does your day look like now? Like, do you eat lunch in your robe and then?
He shaved just for this. It's Thursday. Right. Thursday's not usually shave
business
day.
Business Rolex is everywhere. Cameras everywhere. How did you know I was in my robe?
But don't you have to be a pretty disciplined guy to keep it going, or do you just
I'm not very disciplined. No? See, that's why I focus on writing really good books,
like,
because then I don't have to
just
work as hard.
Put all your work
afterwards.
In, and then you're done.
Well, Neil was saying something about it can be the start of a platform, and it's true. Once this book, the first book, led to a newsletter and a blog and coaching and speaking and additional books, and then that led to another platform. I rolled out in 2010 a book titling and back cover copywriting specialty, because in my self-publishing coaching, a lot of my clients would say, "Do you do book title?" Because I'm not crazy about my book title. And so I was like, yeah, because I'm a professional copywriter, and it's the same thing as doing a tagline or a name for a company or something like that. So it was a very natural evolution. And so that kind of, that was a new direction for me. And that's the kind of cool thing, is that it's just evolved very, very organically. And that's what I say to people. I don't set goals. I have never set goals. I have no 5-year plan. I have no 10-year plan. The idea The notion that I, today, where I'm sitting now, am going to know where I want to be in 5 years, to me, is a ludicrous notion. And I know that flies completely in the face of everything we're taught, but you know, it's kind of the way I've done my business, and it's worked out really well because you know I'm still working for myself.
See, I'm so. His demographic because I don't know where I'm going to be in 10 minutes.
So there you go.
I'll buy your book.
I'll tell you if
it makes me feel good about my lack of goal setting.
In an hour, we'll be at Genki. That's where we'll be.
No, there was. I actually came across a book a couple of years ago. Someone sent it to me. They went on a blurb on it, and it was. I loved it the minute I saw it. It was called. And so this isn't necessarily, I wasn't the first one to come up with this, but I was using it before I saw it, goal-free living. And just so we're clear that this is not a call to, drifting aimlessly through life, okay? One of the chapter headings I thought just summarized the really nugget of the book. It was, use a compass, not a map, okay? And it was just, know the direction you're going in, okay, but don't, and if you know your direction you're going in, you can look at this, it's rich with metaphors, you'll be looking up, and you're seeing what's going on around you, as opposed to having a map and being stuck on, looking down at the map, and you miss opportunities, along the way. So that's kind of how it's worked out for me. It's just like I used a compass, not a map. I knew I kind of wanted to go in this direction, and it happened when it happened.
You got to let me use this line. I'm dying to use this line. Tell us about the next chapter of your life.
I thought you were going to try to get free advice. Stone has a book idea called Stones of Wisdom.
Can I work on your book title for you?
Doesn't grab you? Stones of Wisdom?
I self-published a book 10 or 12 years ago, but I didn't follow that first rule. I didn't write a really good book. I just did it because you could do it.
Exactly.
So I'm thinking Stones of Wisdom. You're not crazy about that, huh?
Well, it has to sit with me for a minute.
But I'll tell you what, this compass versus a map, you're going to hear that again.
That's right.
So now let's get into the book a little bit. Now, the book is, you said, primarily for non-fiction writers, and it teaches you how to write the book, to craft the book, or is it just about the marketing after the fact, or the how to do the self-publishing machine? All of that? It's all of that.
Pretty much. I mean, it does focus largely on the marketing aspect of things, but it really starts even beforehand. Is your book even viable? Kind of thing.
They call you and you just tell them, like you did with his Stones of Wisdom, that that's not going to work.
I got that for free. I got that advice.
Really? No, it's, what you said.
Okay, so then they can get an idea if it's viable. I guess you have some ways to tell.
Go on Amazon. Are there 20 books on your subject?
Does
the world need a 21st? And if so, how's yours going to be a whole lot better than anyone else's?
But is it better to have some in there or none in there?
Good question. If there's none, that could mean there's no market for your book.
Right.
Good example, The Well-Fed Writer. When it first came out, there was one book on the market on commercial freelancing. I mean, there's a million books on freelance writing, but there was only one book on writing for companies freelance. And
so you're okay with one?
Well, it let me, and the guy who did it was like an icon in our industry. And so when I wrote mine, I said, well, I want to go to him and ask him for a blurb for my book.
Oh, so you asked him? Oh.
Yeah, and he gave me one, and it was the best blurb, not that one, it's the one on the back, but, in essence, he said, this is the best book I've ever read on the subject.
And he's the icon. Like,
right. Which might have meant that he just hadn't read his own book.
So then you get the viability, you can tell that, and then once you have the book written, now there's the actual mechanics of getting it self-published, right?
There's two main processes. There's the production process, and then there's the marketing process. And so I take them through the whole step of the production process, including, ISBNs, and there's an alphabet soup there.
So you have
ISBNs, LCCN, CIP, I use a printer. Basically, this book talks about doing it like a publisher would. You're in essence a publisher. You're doing everything a publisher does. Publishers don't have in-house printers. They hire it out to a printer.
Right.
Most of them may not even have in-house designers. They may farm that out as well. So that's what I'm doing. I'm finding the resources.
So the best resources for all aspects.
Exactly. And that's really the key. I kind of want to make this point, and that is that there's so many self-publishing services out there or companies that sell unsuspecting authors on, hey, we can do it all for you. We can design it.
Well, because that's what people want, that one-stop shop where you don't...
Yeah, but the fact is that you're going to get inferior quality and pay more for it if you go that route versus finding the resources yourself. And, you know, and I have a bunch of resources in the back, so it's not like it's hard to locate the good ones, you know, so it's just that people get seduced by the idea of the one-stop shop and they end up with a inferior product.
Now, if you're a nonfiction author, should you, things that you should do is you got to get an editor, right? You
can't, absolutely.
That's not something you're going to just have.
Absolutely. I don't care. I mean,
my cousin that has a degree in English. I need a real editor, right?
Well, and that's really the key. That's all part of writing a really good book. You know, mm-hmm. It's not just the content of the book. It's that it's, you know, it's well edited and all that. Yes, you have to invest some money into that. Even if you're doing just an ebook, people think, oh, if I'm doing just an ebook, it's, you know, so much less expensive. No, because you're still doing editing and cover design and interior layout and indexing. And, you know, the only thing you're not doing is the actual printing. So,
Is that a viable strategy, just doing ebook?
It depends. I mean, you know, people they'll hold up the half dozen success stories, and people go, "Oh wow, you know, I can do this too." And it's like, well, yeah, but they may have just hit the right formula at the right time. I think it's still exceedingly rare. But the other way it can work is if you have some very esoteric information. You know, you're an expert on some obscure technological something that a certain group of practitioners needs to have this information to do their jobs better and whatever. And, you know, in that case, you could charge, you know, $100 for a, you know, $50 or 50-page ebook if it was the right kind of information. So in that case, and of course, something that's constantly evolving where it doesn't make sense to print books, you know.
What about the strategy of like a James Altucher who cranked out a bunch of free or low cost ebooks?
With a goal eventually of
I'm sure at some point there's going to be changing hands.
Well,
I don't think that's sustainable.
Right. You don't make much, but you make up for it in volume right? So, I mean, there's a lot of ways to do this, and that's one of them. Another is giving away chapters of your book, and then eventually, and you know, kind of keep pushing people to buy the whole thing.
At a dollar at a time.
Right. Or just, you know, buy the book now, you know, tired of waiting for the next installment, you know, kind of thing. So there's any number of ways, you know, to go about doing that. So,
okay, it's my turn again.
All right, good.
I'm going to ask this question again because I worked on it like all last night during my pre-show research.
Okay.
Tell us about the next chapter of your life. No, what's next?
Remember, I don't set
goals. He doesn't
goals.
Have a goal.
That's why we ducked the question.
Right.
Okay.
I'm really not sure. I'm looking at a number of things. I'm looking at an idea of a membership site. For mm-hmm. the well-fed writer crowd, which would basically be a place that anyone who's who wants to be a well-fed writer could come and post questions in various tracks. There could be like a case study track and a direct mail track and a white paper track and, you know, whatever. And it would, a membership site is, you know, you pay X amount of dollars, you know, in a given year. And if you
get them in the habit of sending you money.
There you go.
Like there you go.
There you go. You will be automatically renewed in 12 months. So, that's a possibility, and
And you coach people that want to be self-published?
I coach people who want to start commercial writing businesses, and people who want to invigorate existing commercial writing businesses, and I coach people who want to self-publish at every stage of the process. And some people, it's funny, when I first started coaching, you know, actually I think it was a commercial writing client, she's asking me all these questions in the first interview, and I'm thinking, that was in the book, that was in the book, that was in the book, that was also in the book. And I finally said to her, you know, I said, you know, all this stuff is in the book, you know, and she's like, well, I know, I just wanted to hear you say it. And it's like, okay. I mean, it's amazing. People, you know, they want to hear, you know, that they feel better knowing that you're, you know, going to affirm, you know, their thoughts or what you said in your own book. So
if somebody wanted to learn more, website?
WellFedSP.com for all the information on the new book, and TitleTailor.com if you have a book title that just ain't working. Not saying yours isn't working, strong, but just, you know, something to keep in mind. And, of course, WellFedWriter.com. So, and if you're curious about the commercial writing field, you can visit writeinc.biz, which is my portfolio site, and you can actually see what commercial writing is. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the
Thanks
show.
Thanks for having me here.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton and all of our guests here today. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.